Their jug handles make driving a fright. New Jersey barricades add to the blight. So their governor's race was a predictable case, because you can only make turns to the right.
The economic meltdown of 2008 didn't have many silver linings, but you just heard one of them, political cartoonist Paul Laud. Hi, I'm Kevin Coughlin for MorristownGreen.com. Thanks for tuning in. Paul Laud learned the power of cartoons as a Princeton undergrad in the 1970s, and then his quill pen lay dormant for 3 decades. We're thrilled to have his illustrated limericks on MorristownGreen.com every Tuesday and in the Recorder newspapers on Thursdays. And now they can be on your coffee table, too, in a terrific new book called Laughing Out Laud. We asked Paul what it takes to be a razor-sharp political cartoonist. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Kevin. Delighted to be here.
And we're here today at the Morristown Diner to discuss Paul's great new book. It's a collection, an anthology of his cartoons. The cartoons appear in MorristownGreen.com, and they also appear in the Recorder newspaper group, correct?
That's right. This effort began in March of 2010, following in the summer of 2009. Professionally, I'm in the investment business, and 2009 was a pretty bleak year for most of us in the investment world, and I did what any self-respecting investment professional does when things get bleak. I ran out to Vermont for a couple of weeks, and I brought my paper and my pens with me and started drawing illustrated limericks. It was an idea I'd had for some time, and the doldrums and malaise in the financial world in the summer of 2009 gave me a chance to get away for a couple of weeks in the wilds of Vermont and put pen to paper, which I hadn't done in many years. I did a lot of drawing earlier on, especially in college, and I drifted away from that. But I had a block of time.
Yeah, let's give people a taste for this. I'm going to ask you to put you in the spot here and read us a limerick or two, a couple of your favorites.
Alrighty, I'm going to just thumb through. The book is divided into a number of categories, world politics, local politics. I pick on our Governor Christie more than once in the collection. One of my favorites was related to the Nobel Prize that Barack Obama won, and the difficult to describe a comic in an audio presentation, but basically it's a series of Nobel Prizes in the illustration with titles arching over Alfred Nobel's profile, but there was a prize for best intentions, prize for friendliest, for most dependable, reading something like a collection of superlatives in a high school yearbook, and the limerick goes as follows. Boundless hope dispensed at conventions, and change he unfailingly mentions. A nation believes, so Obama receives a Nobel Prize for best intentions. Kind of in a similar national political vein, Sarah Palin is depicted on a copy of her book, Going Rogue, teetering off a pile and looking forward into 2012, and a roadmark sign that says unabridged to nowhere. And the limerick reads, the mistakes are roundly deflected in a campaign quite misdirected, a new how-to book with each misstep she took to help get Obama elected. And, of course, we have a lot of fun with our very own Chris Christie here in...
You seem to have a particular affinity for our governor.
Oh, you know, he's a gift that just keeps on giving and giving. And, in fact, it was one of the earlier cartoons that I had done for this collection. In November of the national turn to the right... you know, you can tie that back pretty much to the election of Chris Christie in November of 2009, which happened to coincide with the election of the Senator Scott Brown in Massachusetts. And who would have thought the Bay State would turn red, you know, on us all of a sudden? But I thought it very poetic that a turn to the right should begin in a state like New Jersey, where it's almost impossible to make a left turn. So the graphic depicts Chris Christie directing traffic and directing everyone to the right in front of a series of road signs that all turns from the right lane and right turn only. And the limerick goes, "Their jug handles make driving a fright. New Jersey barricades add to the blight. So their governor's race was a predictable case because you can only make turns to the right."
I think it's safe to say that you won't be getting any appointments in the Christie administration anytime soon. This is Kevin Coughlin with MorristownGreen.com, and my guest is cartoonist Paul Laud, and we're talking about his new book called Laughing Out Laud, which is published by the Independent Books here in Morristown. You can get it where?
Well, it's available at Amazon. It's available at the Morristown Club here on Elm Street in Morristown. And hopefully soon it will be available on BarnesandNoble.com.
So which comes first, the words or the images?
Well, we start with the limerick. You know, I think good writing can rescue a bad drawing better than a great drawing can rescue a bad joke or a bad bad set of text. So, you know, I start by looking at story ideas, usually beginning. You know, these have to be into the publisher by Monday for publishing the following Thursday. So I begin looking at story ideas, limerick ideas on Thursday or Friday, looking at, you know, what story is likely to have enough legs on it that it will be topical a week from that time. So I tend to choose things that are, you know, more not so much kind of singular type events, but stories that are going to be in the mainstream for, you know, at least a week or 10 days or at least a couple of weeks. So we start with the text, and it'll go through many, many edits to the limerick format, although hopefully they flow off the page as you read them fairly fluidly. There's a very specific syllable cadence, syllable count that you have to conform to get it to get it to work. So we start with the limerick and then see what kind of graphic might come out of it. It's ultimately a illustrated limerick, so the illustration, hopefully readers will find them amusing and well drawn, but the real gist of any political cartoon is the text and the message that's being conveyed in the actual gag that is wrapped around it.
We should know that this morning you're on MG having some fun with Misty Boehner, our new our new weepy Speaker of the House. Something tells me you're going to be having a lot more fun with him as we go forward.
It was, you know, somebody had asked me along the way, you know, do you ever run out of cartoon ideas? And, you know, I get the benefit of, you know, looking at a flow of cartoon ideas that come nonstop out of, you know, 24/7 news services and the human drama that unfolds around the planet day in and day out. And I couldn't make up this stuff. You know, I think it's just a wonderful flow of, you know, I read The Economist every time, I read the Star Ledger, I read the Daily Record, and watch a lot of television and tuned into Fox and CNN and the news services, and my goodness, it's a fire hose of trying to sip from a fire hose of wonderfully wacky ideas that spring forth from the day-to-day activities of politics, of business, of just quirky things that happen.
You seem to be an equal opportunity lampooner, but where would you peg your own political affiliation.
Well, it's funny you should ask that. Following a presentation at the Morristown Club a couple weeks ago, I wanted people to weigh in as to where they thought my political leanings were, and I went up to a couple of parties that were present at that afterwards, and I said, "So, do you think I lean left or right in these?" And they responded, "Yes." And maybe we should just leave it at that.
You know, I particularly chuckle at your depictions, your drawings of Governor Christie. They just, they always crack me up. And I'm just wondering, do you get have more fun with the drawing part or with the word part?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I think in my blood, I really enjoy the, I'll call it kind of fine pen and ink work. I still draw with a crow quill pen and an inkwell. I don't use paint, Microsoft Paint or Photoshop or any of that stuff. I draw an old-fashioned way with India ink at the end of a crow quill pen. That's not a feather. That's a metal nib that's in a holder. But that's the way I learned to draw 30 years ago. And I enjoy the style and the character that you can give a line depicting them through that medium. I enjoy at the same time, I do enjoy the wordplay and kind of the topsy-turvy twisting of words and phrases to get them to conform into the limerick format. I'd say I probably spend the same amount of time writing as drawing. And I'll give a plug to my lovely wife, Katie, who is a phenomenal editor. She's a great wordsmith, a great grammarian. She can take, I kind of consider myself on the writing side kind of the rough carpenter, and she's the fine carpenter. She puts the finish on the gag and will twist a word here or there that really makes it kind of fit and flow much more smoothly, or chooses an occasional word that really makes the limerick resonate.
Well, behind every great writer, there's a great editor. The secret, right?
Absolutely.
This is Kevin Coughlin with TheMorristownGreen.com, and we're speaking with Paul Laud, the cartoonist, who's got a new book out called Laughing Out Loud. Excuse me, a compilation of his some of his best and funniest cartoons. There's a character that recurs throughout, a very special character, a four-legged character. Tell us a little bit about the role of this character.
Well, I think you're referring to Janie the Wonder Dog, the world's most wonderful canine. She's a Bernese Mountain Dog. She's a big, silly, stupid, slobbering, wonderful companion. The original cartoons that I was drawing for the Recorder newspapers were oriented portrait style. That is, they stood higher than they were wide. That was a difficult format for the page layout folks to fit onto the edit page. They preferred, as is the case with most political cartoons, that they be oriented horizontally or a landscape style. When I moved to the landscape style, I put the limerick in the lower right corner of the cartoon frame, and it left this little remnant space in the lower right corner.
Are you saying that Janie the Wonder Dog is right of center?
Indeed, she runs in both directions, though, I think. There was this odd little remnant blank space in the lower right corner of the frame, and I often would try to make the graphic wrap around to that corner, and sometimes it looked a little peculiar, or there was just an object kind of floating there that didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, and I was facing a deadline. I refer to the computer a lot when I'm drawing for images to work from. And the screensaver that I have is a photo of my dog and my three kids. Facing a deadline and looking for something to fill in that little corner, I did a quick rendering of Janie the Wonder Dog, giving her some type of either a pun or a bit of canine wisdom or some little quirky play on words.
She's kind of the Greek chorus, right?
She is. She's a little comic relief. And hopefully if you found the... If you got a little indigestion from the limerick because of its leaning one way or the other, I like to think of Janie's little corner there to provide kind of a soothing after-dinner mint to take some of the edge off the cartoon.
While we're talking about the animal kingdom, I should ask you, do you have any sacred cows?
Sacred cows?
Who won't you touch? Who won't you go after?
It's funny. I try actually to go after subject matter sometimes that's not funny at all. I don't think the role of an editorial cartoonist is necessarily to deal with things that are always funny. Many times there are things that are very, very sad and very tragic that go on. You know, I think part of my role is to talk about things in a way that gets people thoughtful. Maybe deal with things that some other cartoonists might not deal with. I drew a cartoon on the Massey Cole tragedy. It was a major, I thought it was a major story when it happened.
For our readers who may not remember that, we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Okay, there was a Massey, the Massey Coal Corporation has a mine, I believe it's in West Virginia. There was an explosion, an underground explosion that killed, I believe it was 29 miners. This happened in the spring of 2010, and it was a story that came and went without an enormous amount of fanfare. It was in the news for a moment, but then kind of passed on, and I thought it was such a tragic story that it needed to be dealt with. It needed to be dealt with sensitively and thoughtfully in a cartoon, and the illustration that I did was of an empty coal car rattling down a track. A very involved graphic. Certainly there's nothing funny about it. It was a very tragic story. But I just thought the way it kind of came and went in the media, and moving on to things that may have even been a little more superfluous or more perfunctory, I just thought it was a story that was worthy of given the gravitas of it, it was worthy of more airtime and more thought and more reaction by the public. So I elected to do a cartoon.
Can you read us limerick?
Yeah, let me thumb through and find that one. I've been to coal mines in my professional life, and they are horrible places. If you've ever been to one, I think there's probably no hell on earth greater than visiting a coal mine. They're just miserable, horrific places, and when you're underground in one and you can readily empathize with what coal miners deal with, you know, day in and day out. You know, in the preface of the book, I talk about this cartoon in the context contrast with the Chilean miner story, which became a worldwide media feeding frenzy. It had obviously a terrific outcome and a wonderful outcome that they were able to rescue those miners. But I thought, isn't the more major news story when 29 miners perish in a similar type of situation? And I just thought it was a story worthy of much more attention than it got. But anyway, in any case, here is the limerick. Mine cars rattle and slowly roll. This run doesn't shuttle Massey Coal. Through earthen scars creak 29 cars. Each bears a tragic soul.
I'm just wondering, to anticipate some treatment of the awful shootings in Arizona that occurred a few days ago, is that something that lends itself to this sort of a treatment, do you think?
Yeah, again, it needs to be treated in a very, very different way, as horrible and tragic as that story is. You know, I think the details are, you know, still coming out about the perpetrator of this. I saw his rather demonic face on most newspapers, published it this morning. You know, there's a number of stories out there right now, and I'll have to weigh. You know, Chris Christie's going to make his, you know, State of the State message in the coming days. There's certainly the Arizona tragedy. There's, you know, the intrigue of a new Congress arriving.
Is it frustrating that there's too much almost for any given week?
Well, there's certainly plenty to choose from, but, you know, I try to keep a balance, you know, between, you know, politics and business and, you know, singular news events that occur. You know, the tragedy in Arizona certainly has, you know, a lot of dimension to it.
We're talking about the shooting of Congresswoman Giffords and 19 other people, I guess.
Yeah. You know, it has much to say about gun control. It has a lot to say about the forewarnings that surrounded a lot of people that had contact with the assailant, academic context, fellow students that knew him, and the whole kind of backlash of, you know, the, you know, what did the far right do in instilling, you know, a vengeance in this in the assailant?
So there are a lot of threads here, and you have to crystallize them into one cartoon. Ultimately, how will you winnow out those various threads to crystallize it to something that says what you want to say?
You know, I try to look for some, oftentimes either something witty or something ironic. I think irony is a great tool in this type of work. And, you know, I need to do a lot more reading and a lot more inquiry on this to come up with, you know, where is the irony, where is the angle for, you know, a thoughtful, sensitive response to something that's really a national tragedy.
Has your wife ever said, hey, I think you've crossed the line here, I don't think you want to go there, or has a publisher, has your publisher ever said that? Hey.
Now, the recorded newspapers have been very, very open to allowing me great latitude in the work that they publish of mine. They do not invoke any kind of, you know, editorial preempt or license. I do not run the story ideas, you know, in front of them. The work arrives, you know, electronically on their doorstep on Monday mornings as a complete work, and they've never exercised any, you know, editorial latitude on that, even though a cartoon or two has actually resulted in some canceled subscriptions to them along the way.
Which subjects prompted to that?
I had done a cartoon on Benjamin Netanyahu walling up Gaza, and this provoked an outcry from primarily the Jewish community. I thought it was actually a pretty gentle cartoon and dealing with a subject matter, and I thought I was playing it pretty much in the center of the road, but there were those that would look at the cartoon and might potentially be offended by it.
You're listening to MorristownGreen.com. This is Kevin Coughlin, and with me is Paul Laud, the cartoonist, who's just put out a new book called Laughing Out Laud, which you can get on Amazon.com. Tell us your take on WikiLeaks. You cartooned about that very recently. Where do you come down on Julian Assange?
You know, I guess my take on this one is, I think it's largely much ado over nothing. you know, the if there's a culprit here, isn't it really those who had such faulty security systems and protocols in place to allow something like that to occur in the first place? I'm not sure that the course of world events has been changed dramatically by whatever it was that was leaked. And it seemed to me rather preposterous that what seemed to grab the media's attention was this fling that Muammar Gaddafi had with, I think it was a German nurse. That's what made headlines. And I'm not sure that anything that other things that were revealed in the hundreds of thousands of pages, you know, has really, at least to this point, you know, changed the course of humanity in any material way.
So dictators just want to have fun.
I guess so.
Now, you've been stirring up the pot for a long time, way back in your Princeton days. You got in some hot water with your cartooning. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was a freshman. And I did a lot of sports cartoons. But let me go back even earlier than that, which kind of set the stage for it. The president of Princeton University at that time, in 1974, when I arrived as a freshman, was one William Bowen, who was affectionately called Bilbo by undergraduate rank and file. And if you may recall, the 70s was, there was kind of a retro Hollywood dimension of the Marx Brothers and classic screen comedians and the anarchy of a lot of 1930s comedians. The Marx Brothers were wildly popular back in the 70s, and I thought for no particular reason that it would be fun to depict Bilbo as the fourth Marx Brother alongside Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Bilbo. And it was just purely a cheap shot with no justification. I drew it, the Daily Princetonian published it, and I think that set the tone for what would ultimately follow a few weeks later. I did a sports cartoon. I did a lot of sports cartoons at Princeton, and learned to draw tigers exceedingly well and playing all variety of sports, tigers playing lacrosse and football and basketball and rowing and on and on. And the sports editor liked my work, and he said, let's come up with a character that is going to be a news reporter, and each Friday he's going to prognosticate on the score of the following day's football game. And the sports editor was going to write the case as to why it was going to be Princeton up or Princeton down over, you know, Harvard, Yale, Brown, so on and so forth.
And even so, Rutgers in those days, my alma mater.
Even Rutgers. And so I depicted a reporter with a hat with the press card in it, and he was looking into a crystal football. And the sports editor said, in this particular event, it's going to be Princeton over Harvard, and whatever the score was, 22-19 or something. And so I drew that, and we were facing deadline, as we often were, and the cartoon looked a little void to me. And so one balloon had the score. I added a second balloon with my own prediction. And that prediction was that on Saturday of the football game, there was going to be an apocalyptic food fight in Upper Madison Hall at precisely 6:15. Well, you'll never guess what happened.
The power of the pen.
My prophecy did in fact come to pass, and at 6:15 on the nose, the skies opened up with meatballs, and it was, if you've ever read that children's book, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, when apple pie and spaghetti and meatballs and mashed potatoes come out of the sky, that's what happened in Upper Madison Hall that particular Saturday.
I'm guessing here that Bilbo was not amused.
No, the administration did not think this was nearly as much fun as the students did. And the following Monday morning, I was summoned to the administration offices in Nassau Hall, along with a number of senior editors of the paper, we were informed of the extent of the damage and the cost of cleanup that was incurred, and the university was willing to pick up the cleanup costs if the paper would agree not to provide any prophecies of similar import in the future.
If only you had predicted world peace.
No, I thought we should have fought it. I thought this was an egregious invasion of my freedom of speech.
You and the Julian Assange of your day.
I was overruled by the senior editors of the paper, and we accepted the terms of settlement by the university, and I limited my future forecast to football scores.
But you weren't done there, though. You even managed to get on the radar screens of some media moguls, did you not?
Yes, I did. Perhaps the most celebrated cartoon I ever did at Princeton was in the fall of 1975, and the summer of 75, I worked in New York City, and I was commuting, and the world was held in rapt attention by the movie Jaws, and eventually book that had come out, and the movie which kept everyone out of the water that summer of 75, and I was sitting across from someone reading the book and looking at the iconographic image of the shark on the cover of the book, the shark soaring up through the water and about to chomp on an unwitting swimmer going by.
A scantily clad swimmer, as I recall.
And I was looking at the graphic, and I said, there has to be something I could do with that. In that kind of little twilight between consciousness and kind of drifting off, when the kind of the wavy lines begin to kind of go over your eyes, it kind of came to me that there was a wonderful play that I could do, the Jaws title, and being a good Princetonian drawer, illustrator of tigers, I thought Jaws could become Paws, and depicted a giant tiger paw coming through the water and about to attack a small little Yale bulldog paddling, doing doggy paddle across the at the surface. And this cartoon captured the imagination of the Princeton community in a big way. It was a big hit when it was published in the paper, and found its way onto T-shirts and posters and coffee mugs and all that sort of stuff. And it came to the attention of the Princeton Alumni Weekly, which happens to go by the convenient acronym of PAW, P-A-W. And they saw the PAWs cartoon and thought that this was really nifty. And they wanted to put it on the cover of the Alumni Weekly, which they did in the fall of 75, and they paid me $50 for the rights to do that.
That was real money in those days.
That was the equivalent today. It was probably around $3.2 million today. And they published it, and a few weeks later, I got a call from the editor of the Princeton Alumni Weekly. He said, "Why don't you come on down? I've got something I want to show you." And so I went down to his office, and he showed me an envelope from Universal Pictures that happens to own the copyrights to the image, Jaws, and surrounding intellectual property. Now, I saw the envelope and said, "Oh, look at this. I'm going to get a movie gig out of my cartoon." And he said, "Well, not so fast." And he read the letter from the legal department at Universal. And it seems they didn't think it nearly as amusing as the Princeton community did. And there were all of these kind of, cease and desists and violation of valuable trade dress and trade property and all those other kind of threatening words. And by this point, the cartoon had run its course. It was, what had been done was done, and there was no further, publishing or proliferation of, that cartoon contemplated in any case. So it was kind of my 10 minutes of fame, I suppose, on the national scene. But it was great fun, and you still see copies of it lurking around offices and the Daily Princetonian office. It's still 35 years later, it still holds a very wonderfully warm place, at least in some circles of Princetoniana.
Well, I hope that none of the lawyers are listening, but I must confess that back in the 70s, I created a similar image for Banner Day at Yankee Stadium, and the Red Sox were swimming on the top.
One parting shot on that story, when the editor was showing me the letter that came from the movie company, he turned the little triangular flap of the envelope up, and so the envelope flap is pointing up, and he kind of slowly pushed it towards me and did the very distinctive jaws, you know, bump, 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 bump.
You're listening to MorristownGreen.com. This is Kevin Coughlin, and my guest is Paul Laud. He's got a new book, Laughing Out Laud, that you can get on Amazon.com. So this is we just went through the 40th anniversary of Doonesbury, Gary Trudeau. Has he been an influence on you? Who have been your influences artistically?
Oh, golly. Well, you know, Gary Trudeau.
He's a Yale guy, right?
Yeah. And in fact, certainly any cartoonist working at a college newspaper in the 70s was influenced by Gary Trudeau, and certainly I was. I did do a daily comic at Princeton filled with counterculture characters, as was popular in those days. I guess in terms of, you know, artistic influence, I guess I'd look more to the cartoon. I think my cartoon style is much more along the lines of, and I humbly say, and I have the greatest reverence for folks like Thomas Nast, who did very, very fine pen and ink work, or A.B. Frost, who also did cartoons of that period and very, very serious illustration. I think that's, I'd like that kind of tight, highly cross-hatched, highly shaded type of cartoon style that's more quasi-serious than a pure cartoon image. So I'd say, with great reverence, I'd say, you know, influenced strongly by Thomas Nast.
He's the Morristown illustrator who gave us the popular image of Santa Claus, the donkey for the Democrats, and the elephant for the Republicans, brought down Tammany Hall, et cetera, et cetera.
I recently read that his illustration of Boss Tweed was ultimately what enabled, it was either Spain or Portugal, where Tweed had fled, and it was based on Nast's illustrations, which were already in Europe in Punch magazine or whatever he was doing his illustrations for, that Tweed was apprehended based on the Nast drawings and not on based upon any photograph, which was not available at that point, where they certainly couldn't electronically transmit an image across the ocean. So I understand that it even had a role in law enforcement. His images were so recognizable and so true to the subject matter.
Well, if he was that good, then that must be the real Santa Claus, too, I guess.
indeed. I guess on the other side, certainly Janie the Wonder Dog, influenced by Walt Disney and those that do more goofy, lowercase g goofy kinds of animal illustrations.
So I guess to wind down here, I'd ask you, what would be your advice to aspiring cartoonists?
You know, you have to do it because you love to do it. I drew for a long, long time before ever getting published. It was something that was just in me that I just enjoyed doing. It was terrific that the Recorder newspapers picked it up. But I worked for a long, long time of work that I just did either for friends or for myself. So I think you have to really, really, enjoy enjoy doing it for its own sake. The added, obviously the benefit of You know, I really enjoy the fact that it is published and that I can, you know, I can capture somebody's attention with it, and that people will, you know, people that read the paper say, oh, you know, I saw your cartoon about Christie or about, you know, about some other notable in the comics, and I really thought that was good, or I thought, you know, you missed the mark on this one or whatever. It's great that people kind of read this and are touched one way or another by it. You know, for me, it was kind of the voice that I can communicate, you know, with other people through. And, you know, I love the idea of kind of coming up with a clever idea, maybe an angle on a story that folks had not thought of, and if it brings a chuckle or makes them think, you know, about it, about a story. I think I like the idea I like about, you know, editorial cartoons is, you know, you can read the edit, you could read an editorial letter or an editorial column, and you may invest 8 or 10 or 15 minutes in reading that. I hope I can convey a story idea to a reader, you know, in 15 seconds of investment time. Your cartoons tend to catch people's eye. They may not want to dwell too long on the edit page if they don't have time, but they'll often read a cartoon if it's there and if it, you know, promises to bring them a thought or a chuckle for a small investment of time. You know, I think the... you know, I think that was the genius of Thomas Nast, was recognizing that many of the readers, or many of the consumers of newspapers at the time, were illiterate and couldn't read, but they could understand the pictures. And so I think he was able to convey political messages through his illustrations more so than the text or the commentary that went along with them. I mean, most people are obviously illiterate now looking at newspapers. But I think one thing we may have less of than we ever did before is time. So if I could convey an editorial comment or theme or thought, you know, in the span of 10 or 15 seconds, I think that's a great benefit for the reader, and I certainly enjoy fulfilling that. Your original question, which was, you know, what you know, advice to aspiring you know, cartoonists. You know, come up with, you know, your voice. Come up with, you know, your angle, with your approach. You know, for me it was, you know, I liked the wordplay of a limerick. I thought it was a little different. I was unaware of other folks doing it. And for me that was kind of a format that gave me enough to play with on the story side, a little more than you'd usually get with a typical political cartoon, that I can develop. You know, I have five lines of text to develop a clever, you know, twist on words or develop an idea. In many cases, in that regard, the illustration is almost secondary to the message of the message of the text. You know, and as many a cartoonist before me has said, you know, political cartoons or cartoons generally are much more about good writing than good drawing. So, again, you know, focus on the quality of your message, the wittiness of your message, the quirkiness of your message. There are a lot of good illustrators, but there are far few good writers. So really hone your craft on the writing side and the drawing. You know, let the drawing be incidental to a clever and funny idea that you're trying to convey.
Well, my guest has been Paul Laud, cartoonist extraordinaire. You can read him every Tuesday on MorristownGreen.com, every Thursday in the Recorder newspapers, of course. We've been speaking at the Morristown Diner, and I'll sign off in a minute, and I'll ask maybe Paul, you can take us out with one more limerick. For MorristownGreen.com, this is Kevin Coughlin saying, listen up, Morristown.
I want to close with the one that has nothing to do with politics or business, and one that does with something that kind of got under our skin literally and figuratively was a cartoon I did on bedbugs. which was probably terrorized many people more so than anything going on offshore. And my daughter actually was good enough to pose for this. The graphic is her lifting up the covers of a bed, and there's a bit of activity going on in the sheets. And we'll close with this. The rogues who darken city streets and scoundrels whom the front page greets are easier to catch and are no terror match to the bugs that lurk between our sheets. And Janie the Wonder Dog adds in that even good dogs have fleas.